constitutional disputation was at the center of political events during the administration of President Andrew Jackson, the seventh president of the United States, who sat from 1829 to 1837. The first significant constitutional dispute we should consider in relation to the administration of President Jackson is the bank bill controversy, which composes part of what was called the Bank War between Andrew Jackson and Bank of the United States and associated banks. Essentially, what happened here was that Henry Clay, long-standing aspirant to the president's position, hatched a plot against President Jackson in 1832. Clay went to the president of the Bank of the United States, seated in Philadelphia, Nicholas Biddle, and asked him please to request a recharter of his bank. The bank had been chartered in 1816 at the very end of the Madison administration, and as in the case of its predecessor, the First Bank of the United States, which had a charter from 1791 to 1811 granted by Congress, this bank had 20 years. So 1816 would the charter would expire in 1836. Besides that, other notable features of the Second Bank of the United States were that the federal government was a 20% shareholder and that the balance of stock was owned by private investors, most of them, the vast majority of them in the United States, but some few of them also overseas. Clay told Biddle in 1832 that Biddle ought to ask that the bank be rechartered, and Biddle's response was to ask Clay why he would do that, because 1832 was 4 years away from the expiration of his bank's charter. He didn't see that he needed a new charter, and so he thought this seems untoward. But Clay's explanation was, well, this is a sure winner. If you ask, he told Biddle, for a recharter, what'll happen will be that Congress, where Clay, as senator and former Speaker of the House, was the most prominent member, the Congress will pass a bill rechartering your bank. In that case, President Jackson will have a choice. Either he can sign the bill, which means you'll have 20 more years, or he can veto it. And Clay thought that in case Jackson vetoed the bill, Clay would defeat Jackson at the next presidential election. So really what Clay was asking Biddle to do was to join him in a partisan maneuver whose purpose was to eject Andrew Jackson from the White House. Biddle complied with this request after not only hearing about it from Clay, but after hearing about it from other leading members of the anti-Jackson coalition, prominently Massachusetts Senator Daniel Webster. And Congress, as Clay had forecast, did indeed pass a law, pass a bill giving another 20 years to the life of the charter of Biddle's Second Bank of the United States. What was surprising about this question to, what was surprising about these events to both Clay and Biddle, as well as their, shall we say, accomplices in Congress, was President Jackson's response. President Jackson not only vetoed the bill, but issued a veto message in 1832 that historian Ralph Ketchum takes to be a redefinition of the presidency. So Ketchum, in his book Presidents Above Party, divides the history of the presidency in two between the first six presidents and those who've come since. In the first six presidencies, the veto power was understood as a device that could be used by the president to police the separation of powers and checks and balances. So, in other words, if the president believed that the Congress had passed a bill that was unconstitutional, he should veto it. And if he thought the bill was constitutional, whatever his policy preferences might be, he should sign it. This helps to explain why there had been that extensive discussion in President Washington's cabinet in 1791 of the bill to charter the First Bank of the United States, obviously a leading measure of Washington's own administration, and yet he held several meetings of his cabinet to discuss the question whether he ought to veto it. We would certainly not expect recent presidents, Clinton, Bush, Obama, to have extensive cabinet discussions of the question whether their chief economic measures ought to be vetoed, but this was the way that Washington saw the presidency, and it was actually the model of the presidency that Clay must have had in mind when he told Biddle that it was entirely likely that Jackson would sign the bill. But, as I said, what happened was that Jackson issued a veto message. It included both constitutional and other material. In fact, you might say that one of the chief portions of the veto bonus of the bank bill veto message of 1832 was a sociological component. So Jackson began by saying, well, yes, it was true that in 1819, in the case of McCulloch versus Maryland, the Supreme Court had ruled that the Congress had power to charter a bank. And yet he said he, as president, was sworn to uphold not the precedents of the Supreme Court, but his understanding of the Constitution. And Jackson said, every major official in the federal government takes this oath to uphold the Constitution, and each must decide for himself what he thinks the Constitution means in the course of exercising the powers of his office. So when it came to using the veto power, in other words, it wasn't to McCulloch versus Maryland that Jackson was going to look, it was to his own understanding of the Constitution. Now, in McCulloch versus Maryland, Chief Justice Marshall had said, among other things, that, well, there had been this bill passed in 1791, and a long course of history had left that bank, that first bank of the United States, in being under presidents of more than one party and with Congresses changing in membership over time. And so, as far as Marshall was concerned, some deference was owed to the political branches. But Jackson's reasoning was no, it didn't matter whether other people had thought that the bank bill was constitutional. What mattered was his own understanding. And he believed that the Constitution gave Congress only a few powers, that power to charter a corporation, let alone a bank, was not among them. And so this bill was unconstitutional. But, as I said before, he had more to say about this question than that. He also said that the bank bill was undesirable because the bank, he thought, was an engine that was used by a few wealthy investors who had inside influence in the federal government to transfer money from the population generally to themselves. And so few people were reaping the profits that were almost guaranteed to anyone who had all of the tax revenue in coming into the United States government in his hand for the purpose of lending out at interest. Now, Jackson said that government didn't have to be a bad thing. In fact, it could be a good thing if, like the heavens, it shared its blessings with rich and poor alike. But in case there were a provision like this that essentially took money from the common working man and gave it to a wealthy, well-connected few, and here he said, and some of them are even British, Italians, Germans. Xenophobia has never failed to appeal to some part of the population, and Jackson certainly was xenophobic. If the federal government or any government were to behave in this kind of way, well, then the average laborer, the common husbandman, other typical people would have every right to object. To the surprise, one might say, great shock of Henry Clay, not only did the veto of the bank bill not render Jackson unpopular, not only did it not sweep Clay into the White House, but it seems to have made Jackson more popular. Certainly clarified the lines between the Democratic Party and its opponents. So, for example, William Cabell Reeves, a senator from Virginia, quit the Democratic Party over the bank bill veto message, and there were other prominent people who quit the Democratic Party over the bank bill veto message, too. The fact that Jackson had adduced these non-constitutional considerations in his bank bill veto message changed forever the role of the presidency in American lawmaking. And so it wasn't going to be long before presidents felt perfectly entitled to insinuate themselves into the congressional legislative process solely on the ground of political, sociological, philosophical, and other considerations, leaving aside the Constitution. And of course, we've become accustomed now to the idea that the president is, in a sense, the chief lawmaker of the country. This as Ketchum said in Presidents Above Party, is traceable to Andrew Jackson's bank bill veto message and the faulty calculation of Henry Clay. The second significant constitutional problem of the Jackson administration is what's called the nullification crisis. And here, once again, Jackson was responding to Henry Clay. What happened was that in 1824, it was clear to all the main actors in American politics that for the first time in American history, in this 10th presidential election cycle, there was not an obvious Virginian candidate. The person elected was not going to be from Virginia. And so all the main players in American political life thought, well, here's my chance. And you had the Speaker of the House, the Secretary of State, the Secretary of War, the Secretary of Treasury, and the conquering general of the Battle of New Orleans, all declaring that they were candidates for president in 1824. The Speaker of the House, Henry Clay, proposed in a speech in the House in 1824 what he called his American system. The American system was essentially an American variant of the 17th century European school of political science called mercantilism. And in his campaign platform, which is really what his American system speech in the House in 1824 laid out, Clay explained that his system had three interlocking components. First of all, Clay proposed that Congress should ensure that there was always a national bank, which of course, in 1824 there was. The second one had been chartered in 1816. Secondly, Clay said he favored a protective tariff. And thirdly, he was in favor of what in those days were called internal improvements. Nowadays, we know these maybe as infrastructure projects or as public works, but they were known as internal improvements. So essentially, these were supposed to be three interlocking components of a federal government program to manage the economy. The National Bank, it was thought, made credit readily available, and after the mode of dirigiste economists and economic thinkers like the Careys in 1824, Clay thought that currency inflation actually made people wealthier by spreading around the capacity for exchange. Secondly, the protective tariff was a tariff whose purpose was not to raise revenue, but to channel American industry and American spending in particular directions. Here we have a distinction that had been important actually during the lead-up to the American Revolution and was going to remain important for many years after, between a protective tariff and a revenue tariff. As the 19th century disputants understood it, a revenue tariff was a tax on imports whose purpose was to raise money to fund the functioning of the government. On the other hand, a protective tariff was one whose function was not to raise money, but to prevent Americans from buying as much of imported goods as they had been accustomed to buying, or as they would buy in the absence of the tariff. Clay thought that the War of 1812 had shown that America needed further diversification of its economy, and one way to achieve this was simply to prevent importation of goods that Americans wanted, with the expectation that if they weren't able to get their hands on imported goods, they would patronize American firms set up to offer replacement goods for the ones Americans had been used to importing. Besides that, a protective tariff would bring in some money unless you set it prohibitively high, and that money could be used, Clay said, to function this internal improvements scheme. Of course, coincidentally or not, and likely not, Clay's internal improvement scheme meant that there were going to be people in congressional districts all over the country who were going to owe their livelihoods and were going to have certain feeling of political affection for, they're going to owe their livelihoods to and have certain feeling of political affection for Henry Clay. Clay ultimately had kind of concocted a program that had positive effects in many different parts of the country. So, for example, the National Bank was headquartered in Philadelphia, in Pennsylvania, but then it had major branches in every single state, and usually in the leading towns in those states. The protective tariff, well, that would favor manufacturing interests such as in Pennsylvania, Massachusetts, Connecticut, New York. Internal improvements, it was thought, in a time when there were very, very few roads in the country, the difficulty of travel in America in 1824 really qualifies America in 1824 as a foreign country compared to the experience we have today. But the internal improvements program would likely mainly favor people who lived in the Northwest, and that included Clay's Kentucky as well. And so Clay kind of, you can imagine him ticking off in his mind, all right, who's going to vote for me because of the bank provision? Who's going to vote for me because of the tariff plank? Who's going to vote for me over internal improvements? Right along with his proposal of this American system, Clay, as Speaker, also shepherded through the House of Representatives in 1824, the so-called Tariff of 1824. And what the Tariff of 1824 did was to set the standard rate of taxation on imported items at 33%. Now you can imagine the way your own buying behavior would be affected if today America's tariffs were raised from their typical level of between 3 and 6% to something like 33%. I know in my own case, my car is imported, my guitar is imported, my electronics are largely imported. I buy imported clothes very often, and slap a 33% tax on all of these things, likely I wouldn't be able to afford the things I want. In 1828, Congress came back and passed a still higher tariff, this time with a standard rate of 50%. And so people began to argue, well, these tariffs are harmful. They had a disparate economic impact on different parts of the country. As I said before, the Northeast stood to benefit from the manufacturing protection that was offered by the protective tariff, and the location of the bank in the Northeast chiefly was also good for the Northeast. The internal improvements were to be spread mainly across the Northeast and the main, and particularly the Northwest. But notice what section is left out of these calculations. Oh, that would be the South. And in fact, in those days, the South was the chief tax-paying section of the country because a tariff is a tax on imports. The South was the main exporter, and they were also the main importer. And estimates of the portion of American taxes that were paid, that is federal taxes, that were paid by the small portion of the population that lived in the South, come somewhere between 75% and 90%. It was a hugely disproportionate burden that was being borne by the South, which was getting almost none of the benefit. Now, that was not unexpected. In that first American System speech in 1824, Clay actually conceded, yes, I understand that the burden of this program is going to be borne mainly by my Southern brethren, but I believe they're patriotic enough that they're going to be willing to do it. And Clay's nonchalant statement about this turned out to be one of the chief political miscalculations in 19th century American political history. Right? Southerners did not prove willing just to pay the tariff. In 1828, John C. Calhoun of South Carolina, the vice president and an opponent of Calhoun's, I'm sorry, of Clay's, wrote what was called his Fort Hill Address. Here we have a moderate position in the context of South Carolina, a moderate position on the tariff. What on the state's response to the tariff. What Calhoun did in the Fort Hill Address was extend the reasoning of the Virginia and Kentucky resolutions. So in the Virginia and Kentucky resolutions, recall that the Virginia and Kentucky legislatures had gone on record saying that the federal government was created by the states for their own purposes, and in case it exceeded those purposes by grabbing at more power, nullification was the rightful remedy, was in Jefferson's draft version of the Kentucky resolutions, and Madison's Virginia resolutions said, quote, "The states have the right and are in duty bound to interpose," without quite making clear exactly what interposing means. Well, in 1828, the South Carolina legislature adopted a document as its official position called the South Carolina Exposition. Here, as in 1798, the vice president was the anonymous author. But what happened here was that South Carolina's legislature went on record saying a nullification is the rightful remedy, states have the right and are in duty bound to interpose, and then spelling out what that meant. So as they understood it, the states had created the federal government through their ratification conventions. That's where sovereignty lay in the federal system. And in case a state legislature believed that the federal government had adopted a policy that was unconstitutional and dangerous, that state could call an election for another such convention. That convention then, as the sovereign people of the state, could weigh the question whether the federal policy in controversy was actually unconstitutional. In case it was, the state would have the power to nullify that policy. In other words, to say, we're not going to allow it to be enforced within our territory. This would not be the end of it. The other states could, if they wanted to, weigh in at that point and say, we think this policy actually is constitutional. If three quarters of them did, that would be dispositive. And then the nullifying state would face a choice between, on one hand, submitting to this policy that it had judged unconstitutional, and on the other hand, seceding from the Union. So, right after the adoption of the South Carolina Exposition by the South Carolina legislature, the next thing that the legislature did was adopt the South Carolina Protest. And what the protest said was that the tariff of 1828, which Southerners had come to call the Tariff of Abominations, was the kind of policy that the states were entitled to nullify. The Tariff of 1832 took the rates even higher, and at that point, the legislature called for a special election for a nullification convention. When the election was held, about two-thirds of the delegates who were elected were members of the nullification party, people who had pledged to nullify the Tariff of 1820. For the tariff of 1828, the tariff of 1832. The convention did vote to nullify those tariff laws prospectively. In other words, they said, on X date, we're going to cease allowing these laws to be enforced within South Carolina. And what happened then was that they also said that from that point on, if you were going to hold public office in South Carolina, you had to swear to uphold this nullification ordinance. And that included even people who are going to be on juries, even federal juries. So if the federal executive tried to prosecute people for interfering with the enforcement of the tariff in South Carolina, even the jurors in federal courts were supposed to have been sworn to uphold the nullification ordinance. Well, at that point, President Jackson decided he had had enough of this kind of behavior from South Carolina, and he responded with his famous 1833 Nullification Proclamation. In his proclamation, he said secession was unconstitutional, nullification was unconstitutional, and any attempt to nullify any federal law would be met by him as treason. The people of South Carolina, which was Jackson's native state, he said, had been misled by their leaders. At that point, Clay stepped in to try to work out a deal between a deal that could be acceptable both to Calhoun and his nullification supporting friends and to the Democrats. Jackson instructed congressional Democrats not to talk to Calhoun. Calhoun resigned the vice presidency to accept his state's appointment to the Senate, where it was hoped he could make the argument on behalf of nullification, but Clay went to him and tried to work out an arrangement. And what ultimately happened was that the Congress did agree over the next 10 years to cut the tariff rate by 3% per year, back from 50% down to 20%. And Clay himself pledged that he would not attempt to hike the tariff up beyond the level that he and Calhoun had agreed to. Congress also, at the same time, passed what was called the Force Bill, authorizing the president to use force to enforce the law in South Carolina. The idea here was that perhaps the army would have to be sent or led by President Jackson into South Carolina to ensure the enforcement of this force, the enforcement of the tariff laws. And at that point, not only was South Carolina drilling its militia, buying new weaponry, buying munitions and uniforms and so on, but the governor of Virginia had decided that in case the federal government set out to attack South Carolina, the Virginia militia would resist. Here we had in embryo a possible civil war involving South Carolina touching off a conflict with the federal government, and Virginia finally deciding that although it did not accept that nullification was a constitutional mechanism, still the federal government was not entitled by Virginia's reading to attack a state, and so it could well have had this force bill lead to civil war in 1833 if it hadn't been for Clay's working out this deal with Calhoun to reduce the tariff. Hearing about the Clay-Calhoun agreement and the law that was passed to implement it, the Nullification Convention met again, nullified the force bill, declared victory, and adjourned.